It is time for Making Sausage, where we figure out the messy business of politics. Joining us in the studio is DFL commentator Colleen Nardone, and from the Capitol, DFL senator from Virginia, Tom Bach. He is the Senate Minority Leader. He's currently in his fifth term. Senator Bach, thanks for taking time with us today.
Oh, happy to be on with you this morning.
Well, Tom, you've been busy already, and the session's only a little over a couple weeks old.
Well, some of that is, you know, there's a pretty large contingent of Capitol Press Corps, you know, from all over the state that are officed in the Capitol, and they all come back after a hiatus during the interim, and they're excited about their jobs too, and they're looking for something to write about. So it seems like we make a lot of news real early. The press is excited about the legislature, you know, getting back into session. Not that lots of things are happening, but you start to see what issues are going to kind of boil, you know, boil to the top of in the state's interest.
Well, one thing I'd like to ask you about is something they haven't done yet, and I'll introduce it by saying I heard a member of the other party on TV a few weeks ago saying that some of the commissioners were unlikely to be confirmed, and I've been monitoring that, and I noticed that you have not been initiated hearings or anything as near as I can tell to confirm Governor Wall's appointments, and I'm wondering what your take on that is.
Well, I think the number is 22 or 23 commissioners in the administration that under the Constitution, the state Constitution says that they serve only with the advice and consent of the state Senate. So if the state Senate never takes up their confirmation, they're always an acting commissioner. If the state Senate takes it up and rejects the appointment, the individual's done immediately. No two-week notice. They're out of work after the Senate voting board lights up. The way the process works is the governor submits to the state Senate a letter naming somebody to be confirmed for one of the state agencies, whether it's DNR or IRRRB or Pollution Control Agency, Transportation, Health and Human Services, Public Safety, the long list of them. The governor submits a name in a formal letter to the Senate. That the Majority Leader's office then receives that, sends it down to the appropriate committee. Actually, I should say not Majority Leader. That actually goes to the President of the Senate. And then it's referred to the appropriate committee with jurisdiction over that area of state government. And the Senate rules then have a provision in it that say, after a period of 60 calendar days, if the committee has not acted on the governor's recommendation, then the letter is automatically pulled out of the committee and sent to the full floor of the Senate and put on something called the confirmation calendar. And then it really is in totally control of the Majority Leader of the Senate, who, you know, orders the floor business of the day, whether he'll ever take up the confirmation calendar or not, if the committee hasn't heard the individual's testimony. Now, oftentimes that will happen. You know, this all happens in a budget year. Committees get very, very busy. Sometimes confirmations will slip. They'll end up under the rules, sent back to the Senate floor. The Majority Leader very often then will send it back down to the committee and say, have a hearing on this person so we know what the advice of the appropriate Senate committee is. So the committee gives something called advice and consent to the full Senate. And then the full Senate votes on the committee action. It's unusual for commissioners to be rejected. I think generally most legislators, including myself, think an incoming governor should be able to assemble his own team. The Senate is just there as a bit of a safety valve in the Constitution, as a co-equal branch of government. But they do get rejected from time to time. I remember under Governor Ventura, his Commissioner of Commerce, once he was named, ran into some ethical problems after his nomination, and he was actually rejected by the state Senate. Under Governor Plante, his commissioner of education wasn't from Minnesota, was from somewhere else, and had brought with her some baggage that the DFL-controlled Senate at the time thought was problematic relative to school vouchers and her promoting them. So the commissioner of education under Plante was rejected. Also under Plante, former representative Carol Molnau was nominated to be the commissioner of transportation. That was rejected by the Senate. And then in most recently in the Dayton administration, Senator Ellen Anderson from St. Paul was nominated by the governor to be a commissioner of the Public Utilities Commission. And in 2011, and that was rejected by the full Senate, and he had to name someone else. So it does happen, but in all my time here, I've only seen it happen four times. So it's unusual, but it's possible. But if it's not taken up, the individual continues to serve in the capacity of commissioner, receives the same pay. They're titled just as acting commissioner rather than commissioner.
Well, that's actually, I learned something here. That's good to know. Thank you.
So they go to work right away, whether or not they are confirmed?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. And the classic example is at DNR. Back during Arne Carlson's administration, Rod Sandel was the governor's pick to be the commissioner of DNR. I'd have to go back and look, but I'm not sure he was ever confirmed during his entire tenure as commissioner of DNR. And frankly, it was Range legislators, Doug Johnson and Bob Lessard, who really objected pretty strongly to Commissioner Sando, some things he had done when he was running the Division of Forestry over at DNR prior to being named commissioner. So they always felt like, well, you know, if we never take him up and confirm him, the Senate will have a little bit of a handle on maybe some of his actions as commissioner, kind of, you know, holding it over his head. I don't believe he was ever confirmed. So it does happen. It's a little unusual, but it does happen.
Well, I've been impressed, frankly, with the commissioners that were appointed. And I'm particularly excited about the education commissioner, who is a public school teacher like myself. It's so nice to see somebody who actually was a teacher and knows what goes on in the classroom. And there's some interesting things coming up there related to education from what I see in the news. I believe you saw a demonstration yesterday by citizens who want more school choice. And I'm hearing that there are going to be some changes in special ed. I know that's not one of your committees, but are you aware of what's going on there?
Well, the whole school voucher issue, allowing essentially parents to take, you know, the money that the state pays and enroll their child in any school they want, public or private, it's not new around the legislature. You know, people can open enroll now in the public school system. Mm-hmm. That was something that Governor Perpich did. Very popular, and a lot of students open enrolled in neighboring districts. But we don't allow the money to follow the student into private schools. There have probably been bills every year that I've been here permitting that. And I believe Wisconsin has a system like that, a voucher-type system that allows students to attend private schools, but that's not the case in Minnesota. And on special ed, there's the big letdown in special ed. And, you know, we spend a lot of money, and we should, making sure that kids with special needs can develop to their, you know, maximum potential. And a lot of money gets spent at it. One of the challenges, well, two challenges in special ed. One is it's mandated by the federal government that we do this, and they in federal law, it says that the federal government will pay 40% of the cost of this mandate. They have never done that. In fact, I'm not sure they've ever been out of the teens in what they actually send the state in special ed money, even though in federal law it says they have to pay 40%. they just ignore it and don't appropriate the money. So the special ed burden really falls on the state. And where it gets tricky is when students are open enrolled in a different public school, the law allows the receiving school district that receives a student who doesn't live in their district, but under open enrollment is going there. Let's say a student from Big Fork was going to, for whatever reason, enroll in Little Fork. Little Fork could bill the Grand Rapids School District for whatever the cost of that special education is, called a cross subsidy. So, and in a lot of cases, school districts are being billed for pupil units they don't have that reside in their district, but they're being billed by a neighboring district for the cost of special education, and it's really expensive. So school districts that are on the paying end of that oftentimes come to the legislature and say, listen, we need some help with this cross subsidy. We got school districts, you know, billing us tens of thousands of dollars a year for one pupil. And so there's a bill floating around, and interesting, I'm actually meeting this morning with the superintendent of the Duluth schools, because they have a problem with one of the other schools, and I actually don't even know if it's the charter or the private school, that have got some Duluth special ed kids that they're billing the Duluth school district for, and the Duluth school district feels like they're just being absolutely paying way more money to educate those special ed kids than they would if they had stayed in the Duluth school system. So it's a very legitimate problem. It's something the legislature has never really been able to get their arms around, but it does seem reasonable. And I think Duluth is going to come this morning and ask me for some kind of cap on what a neighboring district can bill back to the school district of residence of the pupil.
Special ed
is a huge cost.
Have you thought about the state subsidizing some of those? The reason I ask is, I used to do special ed at the International Falls School District, which is of a size where they have to send kids out of district with severe problems that require residential care, but they're not a big district. So when they take a large amount from that budget, it hurts. And I'm thinking that maybe the state could subsidize the districts a little bit for when they have to send kids out, because those kids really belong to all of us, in the sense that they're going to be living right here in Minnesota with every one of us for the most part, and would be nice if we could pick up a share of that.
Yeah, you know, I think you're absolutely right. It would be nice if the state could do that. The interesting thing about, let's say, Education of Minnesota, for example, because they're kind of the real advocates for additional school funding, is they generally want the money on the formula. So on the regular formula aid that the state pays school districts, you know, Grand Rapids probably, you know, I'd have to look, but probably gets $10,000 a pupil from the state, something like that, to educate the kids. Generally, there's a lot of pressure. Put it on the formula. Let the local school board decide how they want to spend it. And that seems to have kind of always carried the day. Now, if I was the teachers union, that's what I'd want, too, because I would want as much money as possible available at the bargaining table to negotiate wage increases. So always a little controversial when the legislature kind of earmarks money and says, well, here's some money, school district, but you have to spend it on this, whether it's special ed or staff development or any of the other categorical areas, career and technical. I think both the teachers union, probably the school boards and the school administrators want as much flexibility as they can have over their budgets, because, you know, different schools do have different challenges. But you're absolutely not wrong, Colleen. It's a serious issue, and for whatever reason, we have a growing population of special needs students in our system.
I know, and it's increasing drastically. I've been retired for about 7 or 8 years now, and towards the end of my career, I was seeing such a much higher percentage of it than when I started out. And it was legitimate. It's not that they're padding their numbers with kids that don't have problems. It's a legitimate need.
Well, yeah, my sister is retired now, too, but she taught in the Mountain Iron School District for over 30 years, and she taught special ed the entire time. And so I visited her a few times at school and kind of just so that I could understand what special education was about. And you watch the challenges that special education teachers have. And, you know, all parents want their kids to be mainstream to the extent that they can, and that's very difficult with some children, with the needs that they have. But special education teachers have a pretty special place in my heart, dealing with the challenging students that they're dealing with.
And always an important issue is health care. Do you see anything on the agenda for health care in this year's session?
Well, you know, I wish we could do something with the runaway costs of health care. It is still the number one issue on the minds of voters, the polling that I've seen, and it's first by a long shot. You know, President Obama tried with the Affordable Care Act. It was somewhat watered down by President Trump when he took away the individual mandate. So, and Minnesota didn't get a lot out of the whole Affordable Care Act. Minnesota had done a much better job than pretty much every other state, but for maybe Massachusetts. We had about 94% of our state's residents insured before the Affordable Care Act ever came along. So we didn't get a lot out of it, but we're suffering the same thing that all states are suffering, and is the cost. And you know, it's easy to blame insurance companies. You know, they're kind of where we interact, right? They're where we get our referrals. They're where, you know, scrub the bills. They're the ones that we see the charges come across from what our co-pays and deductibles are. But the fact of life is healthcare is getting increasingly expensive, and the insurance company's not the one generating the cost. They're paying the bill. But that oftentimes is who we blame. But as a society, we've got to have a real tough conversation about an overutilization of health care. And when I go to the Mayo Clinic for my physicals, and I just went last week for a two-day physical, and they wanted to order a couple tests because I've got high blood pressure, and I said, do you really think that's necessary? And the doctor said, well, why would you ask that? You know, and I said, you know, so I raised the issue of, we do a lot of testing that, is it really necessary? And we do it repeatedly and repeatedly and repeatedly to, you know, track a person's health. And sometimes I feel like we're not very good consumers of healthcare. We don't shop for healthcare like we shop for other things to try find the best price. And we want it by convenience. You know, if you're in Grand Rapids today and you've got hurt over the weekend and you need to get a CAT scan, or maybe you need to get an MRI, people don't want to have to drive to Hibbing, you know, or to Bemidji to get that. They want to be able to get it at home in Grand Rapids. And so we built a lot of facilities and a lot of equipment, very expensive technology all across. I just kind of look at across the Iron Range where I live. You know, I used to be able to, if I wanted to get a CAT scan in the Little Cook Hospital, I had to wait for the mobile van to come, or I had to go to Hibbing. Well, they figured out, geez, we're sending a lot of business to Hibbing, and this mobile van's getting a lot of business. We could add on here, buy our own equipment, and it could be a little revenue generator for the hospital. So that's kind of what's happened all over the country, is I think we've kind of overbuilt some of the infrastructure because the public wants the convenience. But, you know, that all has to get paid for. It's not like that in Canada. I mean, if you want to get a knee replaced in Canada, you're going to wait. And you're not going to be able to do it in every town you want to get it done in. But we're just not there as a society yet to have the conversation about becoming better shoppers for healthcare. We still want it by convenience, and it's incredibly expensive that way. And, you know, that's only one of the issues. Prescription drugs are one of the huge drivers, and I don't understand why drugs cost so much in this country compared to our neighbors in, say, Mexico or Canada. It's just obscene. What's going on with the cost of prescription drugs. And every new one they develop for another course of treatment, is an additional cost. And drugs are doing a great job of extending people's longevity. I mean, we've gotten a handle on cholesterol, and we've for the most part gotten a handle on things like blood pressure. We've got cancer treatments that no one ever dreamed of, and people living much longer. And much of that's attributable to pharmaceuticals. And that research, of course, to develop those drugs is really, really expensive. But I wish I had an answer to the problem. But we're going to continue to see increasing costs, I'm afraid. And at the state level, back during Arne Carlson, we created Minnesota Care, that low-income working people would have an option for health care if their employer didn't pay for it. And now that's essentially going away because the tax, something called the provider tax, 2% provider tax, that paid for it and has been paying for it since the 90s. In 2011, the Republicans repealed the tax. So they put a sunset on it. So at the end of December, the provider tax that pays for Minnesota Care, in addition, we get some federal money to pay for it, but it's going away. So the program's not going to be sustainable. It's one of the biggest challenges of this legislative session is to figure out what are we going to do with Minnesota Care. We either have to renew the provider tax or some kind of hybrid of it, some way to keep Minnesota Care going. And that's largely a rural program. Salaries tend to be lower in rural Minnesota. Employers are smaller. They don't have as many employees. They probably can't afford to provide health care. So Minnesota Care has become a very, very important health insurance program. And I just want to remind everybody listening, this isn't Medicaid where the government's paying for people's health insurance. This is a state plan. The state negotiates lower reimbursement rates to the medical providers that you go to see. But they're all working people that are paying a premium. And the state subsidizes it with the provider tax on the industry. But it's one of the big challenges we face in this session is, what are we going to do? It's on its own. If we don't do anything, it's going to go away. Probably not this year because the tax isn't expiring until the end of the year. And there's a little bit of a carry forward in the account. And maybe you can get through 2020, but the longer you wait, the harder it is to put the money together to keep the program going. So I do think something has to happen and something will happen this session to keep Minnesota Care a viable option for people.
Senator Tom Bach, Minority Leader of the Senate, DFLer from the Iron Range. We hope to check in with you as the session continues. Thanks so much.
No, I'd be happy to. Stay warm up there.
Okay, thanks a lot, Tom.
I tell my neighbors just for fun. I live up on Lake Vermilion near Cook, and I tell my neighbors I go south for the winter. but the truth is, 200 miles does make a difference.
Yes, that's true. Thanks, Senator Bach.
Okay, thank you. Have a great day, everybody.
You're listening to the Thursday Morning Show. DFL commentator Colleen Nardone in as well. If you missed some of that conversation, it'll be available later today on our website. Thanks, Colleen.
Well, thanks for having us, Heidi.